KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Republicans in Congress want to cut billions from Medicaid. Democratic governors say the plan is disastrous. We speak with Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Students in Maine are caught in a battle between President Trump and the state's governor, Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. At one rural school, federal funding plays a big role in students' lives. Teachers fear what could happen if it goes away. Also, Health Secretary RFK Jr. will defend his mass layoffs and budget cuts to Congress, and how those cuts are making the fight against HIV and AIDS in the South harder. It is Wednesday, May 14th. On this day in 1998, the last episode of Seinfeld aired, a show ostensibly about nothing that became really something. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's going to Turkey tomorrow to talk about ending the war in his country. Russia has said it's sending a delegation, but didn't say who would be there. Zelensky has called for a one-on-one meeting in Turkey with Russian President Vladimir Putin. President Trump, traveling in the Middle East, says he is not sure if Putin will attend. Trump himself is not going, but hinted he could change his mind.
I don't know if he's showing up. I know he would like me to be there, and that's a possibility. If we could end the war, I'd be thinking about that. Now, tomorrow, we're all booked out, you understand that? We're all set. We're going to go UAE tomorrow, and so we have a very full situation. Now, that doesn't mean I wouldn't do it to save a lot of lives and come back.
Separately, Trump met the interim leader of Syria today and says the U.S. could normalize relations with the Syrian government. Trump has announced the U.S. is lifting sanctions against Syria. House Republicans are trying to finalize a massive spending bill. They hope to pass it and send it to the Senate by Memorial Day. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, GOP leaders are trying to solve ongoing party divisions.
House Speaker Mike Johnson told reporters on Monday that he's building consensus with party holdouts.
There's a lot in this piece of legislation, and so it takes a lot of calculation and discussion and negotiation. And as you know, 220 colleagues, there's a lot of different ideas on what the best outcome is, and it takes a while to get there, and sometimes you go right up to the edge. That's how this process works.
One of the divides is over the state and local tax deduction, or SALT. Some members representing districts with high local property taxes say their support is tied to a higher cap on SALT. But Johnson says they're getting closer to an agreement. That may be crucial, since Republicans will need virtually full party support to get this bill passed. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The man charged with attempting to assassinate Donald Trump when he was running for president last year will be in court today. Prosecutors say a Secret Service agent saw Ryan Ruth holding a rifle. The agent fired on Ruth while Trump was golfing at his West Palm Beach club last September. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
At today's hearing in Fort Pierce, Florida, Ruth's defense lawyers will argue that two felony gun counts should be dismissed because they violate their client's Second Amendment rights. The U.S. District Judge hearing the case, Eileen Cannon, is the same judge who dismissed charges against Trump over his handling of classified documents. Ryan Ruth's lawyers are also asking Judge Cannon to suppress the testimony of the witness who identified their client as the person seen running from Trump's golf club. The unidentified witness was flown by helicopter and presented with a single suspect, a handcuffed Ruth. The defense says that was impermissibly suggestive and created a substantial likelihood that he was misidentified. Greg Allen, NPR News, Fort Pierce, Florida.
You're listening to NPR News. A federal judge in Pennsylvania has ruled the Trump administration may use the controversial Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelan migrants alleged to be gang members. This appears to be the first case where President Trump has been authorized to use the wartime power. But this federal judge said that the Trump administration must give migrants 3 weeks' notice before deporting them. Hours of heavy rain in the mid-Atlantic have led to dramatic flash flooding in the mountains of western Maryland and neighboring West Virginia. NPR's Giles Snyder reports the water came up unexpectedly.
Westernport, Maryland Mayor Judy Hamilton says it just seemed to happen all at once. Photos show the downtown area swamped with angry water. First responders used boats to evacuate students and staff from one elementary school, and Allegheny County officials say another elementary school was also evacuated, and there were reports of people trapped in their cars and homes. Westernport is located in a mountainous corner of western Maryland near the border with neighboring West Virginia, where the governor has declared a state of emergency in Mineral County. Officials there were also taken by surprise. More than 6 inches of heavy rain fell on the county seat of Kaiser. Trial Snyder, NPR News.
Three wildfires continue to grow out of control in northeastern Minnesota. The Camp House and the Jenkins Creek fires together have burned more than 30 square miles of forest. The Munger Shaw fire is burning not far from Duluth. At least 140 structures have been destroyed in the fires, including some homes. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The country's Democratic governors are sounding the alarm over a Republican plan that they say would leave millions of people without access to health care. A bill drafted by House Republicans calls for hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts and steps to make it harder to enroll in or stay in Medicaid, Medicaid being the program that provides health coverage for low and middle income households. All 23 Democratic governors have signed a statement saying the cuts will be disastrous. Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky is one of the people who signed the letter, and he's with us on the line now. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
So what are your biggest concerns should this bill become law? How do you see it playing out in your state? Like, what are your top three worries?
Well, my biggest concerns are that people who need health care coverage are going to lose it. Medicaid covers the people we love the most, our parents and our kids. Half of Kentucky's kids are covered by Medicaid, and 70% of our long-term care costs are covered by Medicaid. And so when the analysis that is coming out about this bill shows that millions of people will lose their health care, one set of analysis set up to 8.5 million, that's almost double the entire population of my state. It means that kids will lose health care. It means that seniors will lose health care. And what that means is that families will struggle to make up those dollars and to make up that care. Now, Medicaid is something that also drives and fuels rural health care. And if you remove coverage for millions of people, you remove significant revenue going into those hospital systems. So what we'll see are layoffs, we will see closures, and we'll see folks that live in rural America having to drive hours just to see a doctor. And then finally, the cuts to SNAP are just mean and cruel. You know, my faith teaches me that there should be enough food for everyone. The miracle of the fishes and the loaves is in every single book of the gospel, and in a country where we grow enough food for all of our people. A program like SNAP just makes sure that we don't have hungry kids, that we don't have hungry families, and that ultimately everybody has the basic food that they need to get healthy and to get into that workforce.
Okay. So Republicans argue two things. One is that there's a lot of fraud and waste in Medicaid, and the second is that the program has expanded beyond what it was intended for, and if you address those things, it'll preserve the program for the people who really need it. What do you say to that?
If you're worried that there's fraud and abuse, there are units that are already out there that are going after bad providers. I ran one of them. Just about every attorney general office has one. And if you want to ferret out fraud, better fund those units and you will get those results. But what this plan tries to do is to add burdens to those that are on Medicaid, to fill out forms more often, to check the right box, to create just more challenges so that someone will not fill out something correctly and they'll lose coverage for a certain period of time. It's what I'm also concerned that this administration is trying to do on Social Security by shutting down offices and shutting down the call center and making those on a fixed income drive an hour or two to show up to an office and to not have the right forms. You know, this is an effort just to make it harder for people who already qualify to get the health care that they need.
So there are some people within the Republican Party who wanted more aggressive cuts to Medicaid, who think these cuts don't go far enough, and things that they wanted are not in this bill, like, for example, per capita limits on Medicaid spending. So this represents a compromise from their perspective. Are there things that Democrats should be willing to consider in order to address their concerns?
I think you should always be willing to consider a plan that's out there, but the more hardline Republicans would have almost eliminated, if not fully eliminated, rural health care. You look at rural hospital systems that are the second largest employer in most of the counties that they're in after the public school systems. Many of them have up to 40% of their total revenue in Medicaid. Major slashes to Medicaid, even this plan, threaten that rural health care. And I think that rural Americans ought to be able to see a doctor, ought to be able to go to a clinic, ought to be able to see a nurse practitioner in their own communities. And so what I'd say to those hardliners is go out and talk to the people in your communities. They are not for this. People understand Medicaid in a different way than they did 20 years ago. They realize how important it is to their local economy and to their families.
Let me just jump in here. You only have about 30 seconds left. Given the Republican Party's control of both houses of Congress and the White House, is there really anything that Democrats can do beyond issuing statements like the one that the Democratic governors did to stop this?
We can speak up and we can speak out, and so can all of the American people. This is a really bad plan that is going to hurt families. And when you look at anything from polling numbers to what I hear in communities, they are going to react and react negatively to this Republican plan. This is going to cost Republicans not just in swing districts, but in many districts their seats. And so I hope they don't do it. I hope they don't do it to preserve health care for families. But if it takes electoral pressure, then so be it.
That's Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky. He is a Democrat. Governor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. visits Capitol Hill today to tell lawmakers why he wants less money for his agency, the Department of Health and Human Services. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin spoke with three former health secretaries to hear how they think Kennedy is handling the job.
After just 6 weeks as Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. declared that the org chart was, quote, incomprehensible and the whole agency needed an overhaul. In late March, he posted a video on social media.
HHS has more than 100 communications offices and more than 40 IT departments and dozens of procurement offices and 9 HR departments.
5 days later, 10,000 staffers were fired, not just in HR and IT, but physicians, statisticians, whole centers at CDC, and food safety labs were shuttered. The process was chaotic, and Kennedy added to the confusion by suggesting that as many as 20% of those fired could be brought back. He told CBS in April that going through each job line by line wouldn't have worked.
It takes too long and you lose political momentum.
Kennedy is the 26th Secretary of Health and Human Services. Tommy Thompson was the 19th. He was Health Secretary under President George W. Bush.
I'm not one of those that's going to criticize the the administration or Bobby Kennedy for cutting back, because I think necessary in government at all levels.
He does say he wished Kennedy's team would learn a bit more about the department before they made the cuts, and
I hope that they don't cut programs that are absolutely necessary for public health.
Two other former health secretaries, Kathleen Sebelius, who served under President Obama, and Donna Shalala, who served under President Clinton, both tell NPR they are alarmed by Kennedy's approach to the agency. Here's Sebelius.
I think it's horrifying to not really understand or know what it is that you're doing and what impact it could have on the lives and well-being of people across this country, and then try to fix it after the fact. That makes no sense to me.
Shalala emphasizes there will be economic consequences to these moves.
If you look at the power of just NIH to drive the economy, it's not just a bunch of laboratories with a bunch of scientists. It's the next generation of scientists and engineers. I don't know where Elon Musk is going to get his engineers in the future if you have drastic cuts in science and in technology.
She says when she was secretary, HHS saved the government money by beefing up oversight to identify fraud and abuse.
There's no evidence that when they're breaking down the government with a hammer and bludgeoning these agencies, they know how to put them back together with a new strategy. There's no evidence of that.
Kennedy does have defenders. Roger Severino served in HHS in the first Trump administration and is now with the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation.
HHS lost its way. It lost its vision from making sure the outcomes were there of improving longevity and quality of life, and instead it turned into a money dispensing machine. It was an ATM. Why? Because special interests have captured HHS, and RFK Jr. is committed to ending it.
So is Kennedy rooting out special interests and streamlining the mission of HHS, or is he battering the agency and hampering scientific progress? Lawmakers in two hearings today will have a chance to pose some of these big questions to Kennedy. His answers could determine which of these major changes Congress makes permanent in the new budget. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
A major witness in the federal trial of Sean Combs returns to the witness stand in New York today after a first full day of testimony. Cassie Ventura, an ex-girlfriend of the rapper and producer, filed the first major civil lawsuit against Combs in 2023. And I want to remind you here that the story includes discussion of physical and sexual assault. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
Cassie Ventura's testimony on Tuesday repeatedly underlined an essential element of the prosecution's case, that Sean Combs exerted control over her personal and professional life for more than a decade. Ventura was 19 when she signed a 10-album deal with Combs' record label. She testified that Combs pursued her romantically, but soon grew domineering. Ventura said, quote, "Sean controlled a lot of my life, whether it was my career, the way I dressed, everything." Ventura testified that during this time, she recorded hundreds of songs, but Combs never allowed her to release more than one album. Early in the relationship, Ventura said Combs became violent. She said, quote, "I would make the wrong face, and next thing I knew, I was getting hit in the face." One of the crimes Combs is charged with committing is sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion. Ventura testified that Combs frequently asked her to arrange and participate in elaborate sexual performances with male escorts that he would choreograph and direct. Ventura said these performances made her feel dirty, but Combs kept asking her to do more. She said, quote, "I couldn't say no. I didn't want to make him upset." At the time, she said, she loved Combs and wanted to make him happy, but she felt scared of the violence that might follow if she upset him. Combs sat in the courtroom as Ventura testified for several hours. Combs' defense has argued that throughout their relationship, Ventura was an adult, capable, strong woman who could make her own decisions. Ventura is expected to continue testifying today. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, ProPublica reporter David Armstrong explains why some critically needed prescription drugs are so expensive in the U.S. It's a subject he knows from personal experience. A single pill of the cancer treatment he takes costs roughly the same as a new iPhone. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank. Part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A political battle between the Trump administration and Maine Governor Janet Mills is targeting public school funding. The administration has threatened to pull millions of dollars in federal money because Maine does not ban transgender athletes from school sports. That has left education leaders across the state anxious about what they will do if the money goes away. NPR's Janaki Mehta went to a rural district in Maine where federal dollars play a big role in students' lives all day long.
Happy Monday.
Around 7:30 in the morning, the students of Millstream Elementary jump off of buses and roll into the front doors of their school.
Are you excited about being back at school today?
Yes.
I am. Boy, oh boy.
Longtime educator Barbara Welch greets the students, many who make a sharp left for the cafeteria.
Cinnamon toast, you got it. There you go. Good morning.
Breakfast is one of at least two free meals kids get here at Millstream, which is essential in a community where about two-thirds of the families struggle with poverty.
At home, I ate already cereal, but it didn't really fill me up, so I ate a little more.
I'm glad you came for breakfast this morning. Fill those bellies.
Recently, the Trump administration froze money for school meals in Maine over a fight with its governor. The money was eventually restored, but that experience has made the administration's other threat to pull all federal funding from schools feel real for educators like Barbara Welch.
Our district would be devastated if we did not have these funds because they support a wide variety of different programming.
In this district, federal money made up for a little more than 11% of the budget last year. But it plays an outsized role at the elementary schools in the Skowhegan area, including Millstream. They all receive Title I money. That's the biggest grant public schools get from the federal government. Nationwide, about $18 billion Title I dollars went to schools serving low-income students last year.
Our title program and our federal funds impact our most needy students. They're the backbone of our intervention systems. They help students get on pace.
The district superintendent, Jonathan Moody, says that's the whole idea behind Title I, to close the achievement gap between lower-income students and their peers. The students in this rural area come from six surrounding towns, many traveling for miles without hitting a traffic light. Moody says the school provides more than an education.
Our hope is that the school is the hub of the district, and I think for rural communities especially, you see that schools do become the hub.
So, to see what he means, we took a tour of Millstream Elementary from arrival until dismissal at 2:15 to see the role federal dollars play in a single school day. After breakfast, we head to a kindergarten classroom near the back of the school.
What do you think he says?
Go.
That's going to have a long I sound because we see this E here at the end.
Our tour guide, Barbara Welch, wears a lot of hats, but her day often includes giving extra support to students in the classroom.
Yeah.
Go, mice, go.
That's the kind of work Title I makes possible because Welch's salary is entirely paid for by that grant. In fact, 74 positions in the district are funded by federal dollars, like the teaching assistant in the hallway right outside the kindergarten classroom working with a student on math one-on-one.
You're going to see here in the hallway, this is a kindergartner who has been identified as just needing a little bit more support.
How many do we have now?
Three, four, five, six. 7, 8, 9. 9.
And with that little extra support, we're in hopes that we can kind of close the little bit of gap that we see.
Go up the stairs at the end of that hallway, where a licensed counselor sees dozens of students each week, including fifth grader Rowan.
I come in here because sometimes I need a counselor because of something that I'm struggling with.
Rowan's been getting counseling for 2 years, so we're not using his full name because he's a minor and because of student privacy laws related to mental health.
Kids having a counselor is good because they have someone to talk to and what's bugging them in life.
But the service will soon be limited because the Trump administration has announced cuts to school mental health grants. Right next door to counseling, Rowan also gets special education support, which is also made possible largely because of another stream of federal money.
Okay, let's start reading.
Okay.
Before lunchtime, we head downstairs and around a corner, where two reading interventionists are at work with first graders who get pulled out of class for intensive reading and writing instruction.
Cow and sheep look in the pig pen.
Nice job. It's a big word for us.
Say saw without the s.
Ah.
On.
On.
Reading interventionist Roxanne Davis says these are some of the first graders struggling most with reading.
This is the most important time for them. If they don't read now, they will always have difficulty. We give them a chance to come out of that hole.
That approach of concentrating Title I dollars on younger students seems to be working, because data from the last 3 years shows that by the time Millstream students get to third grade, they don't need the extra academic support.
Hidden.
You are rocking it.
Much of the staff across the district, interventionists, teaching assistants, licensed counselors, meal coordinators, all these jobs are made possible by federal dollars. And Roxanne Davis says everyone at Millstream is worried what could happen if those jobs were affected by cuts.
They're very, very nervous about it. If we were not here, those kids that we work with would not be where they are. Without the funding, the program would be lost and those kids would be lost.
Superintendent Jonathan Moody says he could try to raise the money locally, but that's really hard in a community struggling with poverty. So for now, he says he has no choice but to plan as if federal funds will keep flowing.
And I think cooler heads will prevail. But I'm an optimist. I'm an educator.
For the time being, the kids here are still receiving these services. They seem blissfully unaware that they're at the center of a legal and political fight. Around 2:15, as the school day comes to a close, students rush out the doors of Millstream to the playground.
Cool. How was your day today?
Good.
But second grader Mia Martin isn't eager to leave just yet. School is kind of her whole world.
Basically home for me.
What do you mean? Is school home for you?
Pretty much. If I had a bedroom here, it would probably be the office.
She says her favorite part of the day was sitting down to do what she loves most.
Reading Green Eggs and Ham, my favorite book.
Janaki Mehta, NPR News, Skowhegan, Maine.
This is NPR News.
How does the birthplace of jazz keep the art form alive? Education.
To keep the music going, you have to give it to the young people. They're the future.
Anybody know what this is?
No!
What if I put it like this?
We visit Preservation Hall on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump says he's lifting U.S. sanctions on Syria. The president made the announcement in Saudi Arabia, where earlier today Trump met with Syria's interim president for about 30 minutes. In remarks to the Gulf Cooperation Council, Trump called the sanctions crippling for Syria, which has experienced more than a decade of civil war. The president is now in Qatar. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will be on Capitol Hill today. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, Kennedy is expected to press lawmakers to reduce funding to HHS.
Since taking the helm at HHS, Secretary Kennedy has moved quickly to shrink the agency, firing 10,000 staffers, with thousands more taking buyouts or early retirement. Even though Kennedy says his overhaul is about administrative redundancies, some functions of the agency, including those required by Congress, are now in limbo. For instance, food safety labs are now short-staffed, with some routine inspections delayed or canceled. Lawmakers in two hearings on Capitol Hill will likely ask Kennedy about these cuts. They may also ask about the measles outbreak in West Texas, his new initiatives on autism, and the steep cuts to biomedical research. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington. In Tennessee, the mayor of Nashville is criticizing the Department of Homeland Security for recent raids by agents with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. As Mariana Bacallao with member station WPLN reports, those raids resulted in dozens of arrests.
DHS is touting the arrest of nearly 200 Nashvillians without legal status. Nashville Mayor Freddie O'Connell has decried the raids, but state law prevents the city from adopting sanctuary policies for immigrants. DHS says that half of those detained by ICE have a criminal history. O'Connell has requested the names and charges of those detained because he says he's wary of how people are being chosen for arrest.
There's a strong probability that people have been detained that are here legally that simply did not have documentation with them as they were driving on the streets of Nashville.
In a press release, DHS criticized O'Connell's response to the raids, saying that the mayor, quote, stands by pro-illegal policies. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
Microsoft says it's begun laying off about 6,000 employees. That's nearly 3% of its workforce. Most of those being let go work at or tied to Microsoft's headquarters in Redmond, Washington. Stocks on Wall Street opened higher moments ago. The Dow is up 66 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. April might have felt like a roller coaster ride for the U.S. economy. Tariffs were up and down. The stock market was volatile. The Labor Department's report on inflation yesterday, though, painted a cooler picture. Austin Goolsbee watches those numbers as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's one of the people who gets to vote when the Federal Reserve sets interest rates. And in years past, he chaired President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Now, I asked him why April's numbers were better than expected.
Some part of it is the official data. They only come out with a lag of a month or so. So we're still kind of holding our breath. And if consumers and businesses start freaking out a little bit about uncertainty and pull back on their spending or pull back on their investment, you can get some downturns. When there are moments of a lot of dust in the air, like what we saw a bit in April, you can go into some of this paralysis, but it still takes some time for that to show up in the numbers.
So how do you move then? How does the Fed kind of move in, you know, when policies aren't settled and there's uncertainty still?
When people would ask me, are you a dove, are you a hawk? I say, I don't even know if I like birds. I just try to be a dog.
Yeah.
There's a group of data dogs at the Fed, and the first rule of the data dogs is know the difference between the time for walking and the time for sniffing. And the time for sniffing is when you need more information. Now we've got a bunch of noise that we're trying to figure out the through line. But if we can get past that, I feel like underneath there, that solid, hard data economy is still there.
So is it fair to say that if the American economy were a car, that even though the outside of the car may be looking a little scratched up, under the hood, the engine, everything looks okay?
I guess so. I mean, it's important to remember that the Fed, our job is to be the steady hand, not respond to the daily gyrations, either of the stock market or of policy pronouncements. And we continue to get these numbers that at least suggest that it's going okay.
Yeah.
It's just, I think, not realistic to expect businesses or central banks to be jumping to conclusions about long-term things when you've got so much short-term variability. It's just a very difficult environment.
One thing I wanted to ask about, Austin, is core consumer price index. That excludes food and energy. Those two things tend to be a little bit more volatile, and they sometimes distort the overall picture of inflation. That was 2.8%, unchanged from March. So how much do you pay attention to that core consumer price index as opposed to just consumer price index?
Yeah, a lot. You know, and that can drive my mom crazy. You know, she'll say, what do you mean you're not looking at food and energy inflation? That's exactly what I'm looking at. Now, you'll hear people saying things like super core. Is there a way you could carve out those pieces of inflation that are most affected by tariffs to tell us what would be happening to prices if the tariffs were not around? But we pay a lot of attention to core inflation.
What do you think the American people should kind of glean from these numbers, from what we've seen with inflation? Is it something to be happy about, or do we still need to wait and see?
A little bit of both. You never want to make too much of any 1 month or even 2 months numbers. What I hear walking around and talking to folks is lack of consistency, that if they can't count on what's happening, then they just can't act yet. They just got to sit on their hands. But the official data only come out with a lag. That's why it's at moments of transition extra important to get out and listen to the people in real time what they're seeing.
That's Austin Goolsbee, president of the Chicago Fed. Thanks a lot for your time.
Hey, it's great talking to you again.
Layoffs and budget cuts at health agencies like the Centers for Disease Control are trickling down to organizations that provide HIV outreach and care. Reporter Amy Maxman from our partner KFF Health News traveled to Mississippi to talk with people who are scaling back their work.
Southern states have the highest burden of HIV in the U.S., accounting for half of new infections. At a community center in Jackson, Mississippi, local nonprofits have gathered for a health fair. It's for people without stable housing, who have less access to food, transportation, and health care, all things that put people at higher risk of HIV. There's blood pressure checks, flu shots, and HIV testing. Free hoagie sandwiches are the biggest draw.
Yo, man, you got your lunch? Praise God.
The event organizers have just learned that much of their federal funding has been cut. They're commiserating about having to scale back their work. My brother's keeper runs a mobile clinic that offers HIV tests, but they may have to shut it down. The nonprofit has lost grants worth more than $1 million. Deja Abdul-Haq is a director at My Brother's Keeper. She says Southerners are known for being polite, but this is not the time for tongue-holding.
So goes Mississippi, so goes the rest of the United States of America. It eventually comes to you, so don't dismiss it.
Almost all of the money for HIV prevention in many Southern states comes from the federal government. That makes the region acutely vulnerable. Daniel Edney is the head of the state health department.
This is Mississippi. This is in California, New York. We're not flush. So, having the rug pulled out from under us at the federal level is really scary.
As community groups and health departments pull back on their work to prevent HIV, Dafina Ward says progress could reverse. She's the executive director of the Southern AIDS Coalition.
It will have far-reaching consequences. We're seeing this about face of what it means to truly work towards ending HIV.
The cuts run counter to President Trump's first term, when he launched an ambitious program to end HIV in the U.S. But at the start of his second term, he blocked government funding for programs on diversity, equity, and inclusion. He's called them discriminatory and wasteful. But Ward says equity is actually the most efficient way to design HIV outreach.
HIV transmission doesn't happen in a bubble. The data tells us that the communities that are most impacted by HIV are communities that have been systemically marginalized in a number of ways.
One such disparity is new diagnoses of HIV. The rate is roughly 8 times higher among Black people as white people, according to the CDC. Steeper federal cuts could come soon. In a leaked budget draft, the Trump administration recommends eliminating all HIV prevention at the CDC. I'm Amy Maxman in Jackson, Mississippi.
That story comes to us from our partner, KFF Health News. This is NPR News. President Trump is collecting investment pledges on the first overseas trip of his second term, the latest on Trump's tour of the oil-rich Persian Gulf. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Researchers have found a new predator that roamed the Earth more than 500 million years ago. The fossil, recently discovered in Canada's Burgess Shale, has claws, flappy limbs, sort of like wings, 3 eyes. It's even named Mosura, the Japanese name for Mothra, the giant moth that fights Godzilla. But the real creature was only the size of a finger. Still kind of scary, though. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card, What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Jose Mujica, a former guerrilla fighter who later was elected president of Uruguay, has died. He was 89 years old. John Otis reports on the man whose frugal lifestyle earned him the nickname the world's poorest president.
Compañeros!
On the night he was elected president of Uruguay in 2009, Jose Mujica refused to gloat. Instead, he apologized to the losing candidate for using harsh rhetoric during the campaign. Extending a hand to adversaries wasn't always Mujica's strong point. In the 1960s, when he was troubled by Uruguay's gap between rich and poor and fascinated by the Cuban Revolution, Mujica opted for violence.
So the notion of picking up a gun and effecting social and political change right here, right now, he fell into that.
That's Pablo Broom, who wrote about Mujica in his book, The Robin Hood Guerrillas. Mujica joined a rebel group called the Tupamaros that pulled off bank robberies, bombings, and kidnappings. But the Tupamaros never came close to seizing power, and in 1970, Mujica was captured after a shootout with police.
They spot each other, pull out their guns. Mujica gets shot like 5 times. He shoots other people. And he has said that he'd never killed anyone because of his bad aim.
He recovered in prison, but didn't stay there for long. Instead, he helped fellow inmates build a 130-foot tunnel.
Pasábamos por un patio a la otra casa.
In this documentary, Mujica explains that the tunnel led to a house across the street from the prison, and that he and 105 other Tupamaro guerrillas escaped. But most were quickly rounded up. Mujica was beaten and tortured. He spent so much time in solitary confinement that he befriended ants, frogs, and rats. Mauricio Rabuffetti interviewed Mujica for his book, The Quiet Revolution.
He spent those years trying to educate himself and also to understand who he was.
Mujica was released in 1985. By that time, Uruguay's dictatorship had given way to democracy, and Mujica jumped into electoral politics. He was elected to Congress in 1994, named agriculture minister in 2005, and 4 years later, won the presidency. Yet high office didn't change him very much. Rather than a presidential motorcade, he would drive his 1987 Volkswagen Beetle to work. He dressed casually and donated nearly all his salary to charity. His point, which he made in this speech at the Rio Earth Summit in 2012, was that overconsumption is killing the planet and that we can all get by on less. As president, his progressive policies included legalizing abortion, marijuana, and same-sex marriage, and taking in Afghan war refugees. By the time he left office in 2015, Mujica had overseen an economic revival. In his twilight years, as the world became more polarized, Mujica looked back on his own extremist past with chagrin and endorsed moderation.
Que el odio termina estupidizando.
He said, life has taught me a hard lesson, that hatred just makes us all more stupid. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The new film Magic Farm follows an American TV crew led by Chloe Sevigny looking for the next viral artist, but they land in the wrong town, in the wrong country. Director Amalia Ullman told me about how the crew completely misses the very real story of pesticides being dumped on an Argentinian town.
Especially in Latin America, you would have to deal with like a lot of layers of corruption, like pretty dangerous situations and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I mean, staying longer to do a story on the environmental effects of the pesticides, that would require a lot more money, a lot more time. And would a corporation maybe that owns this crew be willing to do that?
Exactly. Yeah. There's a level of privilege in like the idea that you're like allowed to complain about things and protest things. And I think that's a very American thing. But there's a lot of countries that the level of corruption are so high that to fight against a corporation might get you dead. And I kind of wanted to show that.
In the film, you play Elena, part of the documentary crew, and the only one who speaks Spanish. Now, I want to play a clip from a scene early on in the film that I think for me kind of illustrates the crew's presumptuous cluelessness. Let's hear that clip.
Elena, what is that?
Oh, that's very common here. They use it to congratulate people when they graduate or to announce weddings and stuff.
They never have things like this in America.
Well, we are in America. We're in South America.
Okay, well, in America, all the made in China.
This is about a cheater. It says, if you don't block your ex, you're not coming into this house anymore.
No, now you're glad we don't have these in America, Jeff.
I love that. America, I guess the entire landmass is America. What was going on and what were you trying to say with this scene?
Well, it's like two sides to the story, obviously. One of them is like them being as obnoxious as they are. And the other is like actually weird stuff that happens in Argentina. One of them is these, we call them pasacalles, and they're just banners. And it's pretty common for congratulations on your graduation, whatever, you know, or like having a baby or stuff like that. Or people use it to confront their partners. So if someone's cheating, they put pasacalles in the middle of the street and it can be kind of intense.
On the obnoxiousness of Americans, it's one of those things that I think Americans have known for a long time. Is it just because Americans continue to be obnoxious or they're just clueless and they don't care?
There's such a hegemony still with how American culture permeates the world, American movies, music, etc. Whereas Americans have only been exposed to one culture, which is their own.
So there's this one scene where the character Justin, who's the documentary crew's sound guy, he's played by Joe Apollonio. He clearly doesn't understand cumbia music, and he tries to get the musicians to change the music.
What do you want?
I don't know. I'm no musician, but not like a drowning duck. More Latin, less duck.
Cumbia sounds like that.
Okay.
More Latin, less duck. It's like he wants them to just adjust to his version of Latin music and not what it actually is.
Yeah, but I mean, that's something that I've seen all the time. And
no
I've experienced.
Kidding, really?
Well, yeah, I don't think it's like that intentional. I think it just comes from ignorance and like not having your ear attuned and like, but mostly from ignorance.
If I were part of that documentary crew, I would have spent like a day trying to see and hear the different sights and sounds of the place that I thought I was going to before I showed up there so I could understand the difference and not embarrass myself in front of the two people that live there.
I feel like when understanding Latin America, not understanding Spanish is a big thing. And I've also, because I'm white, I've experienced a lot of people, especially in fine arts, saying a lot of racist stuff against Latin Americans in front of me because they've forgotten that I am Latin American. And there's a lot of Latin Americans in the US that don't speak English very well, assuming they're stupid just because their English isn't perfect.
It's the same thing with my mom, too. My mom had to learn English when she came to the United States from Ecuador, and she's brilliant, but in English, maybe she didn't sound that way. So I don't know, like, does it require more patience and grace from the people that are hearing this?
I think a lot of people in the U.S. have barely traveled to other places. I've never met people more proud of not having a passport. And I think that creates this sort of feeling of superiority, but also lack of empathy when dealing with people that come from other places and have bad English, etc.
That's director Amalia Ullman. Her film is called Magic Farm, and it is now in theaters. Amalia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is Major League Baseball news, but fortunately, we have a resident baseball expert here at Morning Edition, our own A. Martinez. A., tell us.
All right, so players no longer living will now be removed from MLB's permanently ineligible list. That means players such as Pete Rose, Shoeless Joe Jackson could eventually make it to the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
Remind us why they were blocked from the Hall of Fame in the first place.
Yeah, both were tied up in gambling scandals. Now, with Pete Rose, he started playing in the 1960s. He eventually became the league's all-time hit leader, and he still is to this day, 4,256 hits. Now, 4 years after setting the hits record, Rose was banned for life when Major League Baseball learned that he had been betting on his own games when he was player manager of the Cincinnati Reds.
What was the response to that like at the time?
Oh, heartbroken. I mean, fans were heartbroken. They were angry. Even to this day, Michelle, they're still heartbroken and angry over it. Now, for over a decade, I traveled to every major league and a lot of minor league ballparks. When I spoke to fans, most of them either didn't care or could forgive players taking steroids. Hardly any of them, Michelle, could get over gambling on games like Pete Rose did. Though later on, Rose did apologize in his memoir. And after Rose passed in 2024, his family filed a petition to remove the ban, which is what prompted this decision to lift that ban.
You mentioned Shoeless Joe Jackson, too. He was banned, along with seven other White Sox players, in 1921 for allegedly fixing the World Series 2 years before, and I did have to look that up, eh?
Yeah.
Just letting you know.
The film 8 Men Out does a really good job of bringing that scandal to life, by the way. Now, in announcing the decision, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred said that, quote, a person no longer with us cannot represent a threat to the integrity of the game. A lot of the headlines have talked about the possibility of these players getting to the Hall of Fame, but even if that happens, Michelle, it's going to be a while. The committee that makes the list of former players to vote on won't meet again until December 2027.
So, A, do you mind if I ask you, what do you think?
I've always found it odd, Michelle, that one of the greatest, most accomplished, and most popular players in the sport's history is not in the Hall of Fame. I understood why, though. But here's the thing. If he gets voted in, as long as his whole unsanitized history is displayed on his plaque or next to it, then I think that would be an acceptable outcome for most people, and even me.
Okay.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.